Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to Eat Drink Indy Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. We have got a show for you this week that hits on so many aspects of local food, from celeb chefs and dining awards to urban agriculture and craft beer. We'll hear from Iron Chef Michael Simon, who was in Indianapolis last week for the grand openings of some local get-go market cafes, and we'll find out what the Chew co-host thinks about everything from holiday cooking and pumpkin spice anything to his take on the Cleveland and Indy dining scenes, and even a little advice for aspiring chefs. And we'll hear from Indianapolis chef Leighton Roberts of Vita and the restaurant's general manager, Roddy Kirschenman, about being awarded a prestigious 4-diamond rating from AAA, the only restaurant in the city to get 4 diamonds. We'll also talk farming and urban agriculture with Emily Toner of Purdue Extension in Marion County and hear about an innovative new urban ag program that begins next month. And we'll hear about the soon-to-open Cannonball Brewing Company in Indianapolis when we talk with owners Mark and Tanya Swartz and Chef Aaron Kemp. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indy Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We talk with a lot of chefs here on Eat Drink Indy Radio, mostly local ones, of course, but occasionally nationally known celeb chefs are in town promoting a book or a business or a restaurant. And sometimes Eat Drink Indy gets an interview. Last week, I got to talk with Cleveland's Iron Chef Michael Simon, who was in town making an appearance at the grand opening of some local get-go convenience stores. So that's where we were, in a tiny backroom office of the Get-Go Market on Rockville Road. We didn't have much time, but we squeezed in a quick this-or-that style interview where we talked shopping, holiday cooking, pumpkin spice, anything, and the one thing that should definitely be on your burger. Since we are at the Get-Go on Rockville Road in Indianapolis, which in and of itself is kind of a weird place to be, don't you think? So first of all, shopping, okay? So what do you prefer, in-person or online?
In-person.
Okay. Impulse shopping or list-making?
List-making. I'm a Virgo. Sometimes impulses happen, but I have to have a list.
Okay, so you're a Midwest guy. Seasonal shopping or tomatoes in January?
Oh, seasonal all day. I'm not eating a cardboard in January, no.
Holiday cooking, lots of fun or kind of a pain?
Always fun, especially Thanksgiving. I love Thanksgiving.
Family get-togethers, do you cook or do you let people cook for you?
Both. My wife is a great cook. Also, my mother's Greek and Sicilian. She could cook the handles off a pan. And my wife's family, we have a lot of good cooks in our family. So typically, if it's like a, I know this is a longer answer, but if it's like Thanksgiving, I'll cook everything. Because it's, again, it's the Virgo in me. I just kind of have to control everything. But we also often do a lot of like theme kind of things where it's like my wife Liz will pick a theme and we'll do a thing, a friends will bring things. And so, you know, I think it's what happens when you're a chef is you, the people around you, some have always loved food and some grow to love food. So, my childhood friends are all foodies, you know, so go figure.
Okay. For the holidays, turkey or ham?
Ham.
Even Thanksgiving?
Turkey.
All right. Pumpkin spice, anything. Yes or no?
Oh, make it end. Please, God, just make it end. Just put it in pie and call it a day. Just get it out of my coffee. Oh, I can't stand it.
And I have to ask about burgers. The perfect burger topping.
American cheese.
Really?
Yeah. I was farm to table before it was cool, but there is something about that oddly melty cheese that makes me happy on a hamburger.
We've been talking with celeb chef Michael Simon of The Chew. We'll be back with more from the Iron Chef here on Eat Drink Indy Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. When Iron Chef Michael Simon was in town last week, he was making an appearance at the opening of some Get-Go markets. The Chew co-host is known for his Lola and Lolita restaurants, his Mabel's Barbecue, as well as a string of B-Spot burger restaurants. We have one of those here in Indy, and Simon says he's in town every month or so to check things out. So we talked about the food scenes in Cleveland and Indianapolis, our local chef Jonathan Brooks and Milktooth, and Simon's advice to aspiring chefs. I wanted to talk a little bit about Cleveland. Okay, so you've been a big proponent of Cleveland. Do you still feel a part of the local food scene there?
Oh, absolutely. We opened our first restaurant there 20 years ago. It'll be 20 years in March. We just recently opened up our most recent one, Mabel's, about 6 months ago now. And I'm in Cleveland all the time. So, you know, I essentially we filmed the Chew Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. The remainder of the week, typically, I'm in Cleveland. So the great thing about what's happened in the food scene there now that, for me, is very rewarding is not only are our restaurants doing well, thank God, but a lot of people that have worked for us have opened their own restaurants, and they've been very successful. So
yeah, that must be nice. Is that kind of gratifying?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, and then people that have worked for them now have their own restaurants. So, like, I feel like there's almost, like, three generations now of things that we've worked really hard to achieve 20 years ago, which is very gratifying.
So are you able to have some sort of a regular schedule to get to all of them?
Yeah. I mean, as regular can be, I guess. I think irregular is the new regular. But, yeah, I get into all the restaurants very often. You know, Lola, which is our baby, I'm there a lot. Mabel's, I'm still there a very good amount. And then I kind of try to get to all the B spots, like, monthly or bi-monthly.
Well, that was my next question. How often do you manage to get to the restaurants like the one in Indianapolis?
I tried to get out to every location minimally once a month. Sometimes it stretches to 6 weeks or so, but, you know, we're pretty good about it. And the corporate chef of our B-Spots has worked for Liz, Doug, and I for 22 years, you know, and our director of operations has been with us for 17. So, and their responsibility is our B-Spots. So, like, I always kid with them. I'm like, if you don't know it now, you ain't never going to know it.
Have you checked out very many places in Indianapolis? You know, one of our restaurants, Milktooth, was just on.
I was going to say Milktooth. I was saying this to someone earlier. Milktooth, to me, is not only one of the most special restaurants here. I think it's a completely special and unique restaurant, regardless of where it is.
It just hit the Condé Nast list of some of the best restaurants in the world, which was awesome.
Unbelievable. And last year, he won Food & Wine Best New Chef, which I won in the 90s. That's a great award that kind of propels other things like Condé Nast, and hopefully, you know, he'll get his due with James Beard soon, and very special restaurant.
Well, I was going to ask you, how much do things like that help? Was it a big boost to you along the way, the James Beard awards and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think times have changed a little bit with media. You know, I won Food & Wine Best New Chef in 98. You know, back then there were pretty much only three publications that wrote about food, and there was no, you know, Food Network. I started on Food Network in 98, too. It had just started in 96. There was no blogs or social media or all those other things that happen now. So I think they had slightly more impact maybe then than they do now. I still think the James Beard Award has even more of an impact on your community than it even does on your restaurant. Because, like, since I've won, Jonathan Sawyer, who used to work for me, has won, and Cleveland has gotten more attention because of the James Beard Award. So I think it adds a lot to the community.
I was wondering if that was the case. I look at Cleveland, you know, and kind of compare Indianapolis to Cleveland, you know, and so I'm hopeful that could be the case here as well.
I think that's it's happening here, you know, as we speak. I mean, Cleveland, you know, it's been gotten, it has received a lot of praise for its culinary scene in the last 5 years, but really most of that work was done 20 years ago and has continued to grow since then. And, you know, when I look at Indy, I see that same thing. It's like you have that really nice foundation that just continues to grow. And what's going to happen is chefs that work for these great chefs are going to go off and do their own things, and that'll spur another growth. And You know, I think the food scene in Indy is very dynamic and very exciting.
Do you get that feeling sometimes, you know, because you were at this 20 years ago, and the fact that, and then people get all excited like, oh, right now, like something like it's just been in the past few years. But you were there from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, my first executive chef job was in Cleveland in, holy moly, 1991. So 26, yeah, 25, 26 years ago. And then, yeah, and we opened Lola 20 years ago. Yeah, so to watch it happen has been, and to be part of it has been very rewarding. You know, and then two of our restaurants we opened in neighborhoods that were really rough when we opened them up. And to watch those neighborhoods gentrify around them was every bit as rewarding as what's happened with the food scene.
So, you know, the James Beard, there's a James Beard conference next week talking about issues that chefs are involved in. What are some of the issues that you see chefs involved in now, which probably has changed over the past 20 years?
Yeah, I think they've changed, but I think they sadly still remain the same. You know, I think hunger is still a giant issue. You know, we always say the face of hunger looks just like any other face that you've seen, and I think people... sometimes when they think about hunger, they you know, they think about people maybe that are homeless, but actually hunger's it lives in people that have homes and their kids are going to school and all those kind of things. You know, I think it's going to be something that we need to continue to work on in this country. We have the country that has the most waste and the most hunger, go figure. Children's lunches, I still think, although it's has moved in the right direction, you know, I actually think Michelle Obama's done a really good job getting it moving in the right direction. Hopefully that movement continues, that we get healthier school lunches for our kids. You know, and I just think that hopefully that the government rules for how food is produced become a little bit more strict here than they are in the rest of the world. Like, how could bromated flour be illegal almost worldwide, but 99% of the bread produced in our country has bromine in it? You know, how could GMOs be illegal mostly worldwide, but here most of our food has GMOs in it? So, you know, I think some of those laws got to get a little bit more strict. Not necessarily that that's going to make food more delicious, but it's going to make it much safer for our kids and our kids' kids and so forth.
Are you optimistic about how the interest in food is going, and is it going to help?
I'm very optimistic. I think that I see how much food has changed and how much more people, you know, I think the Food Network has had a bigger impact on America than maybe sometimes we even realize. People are more aware of what's in their food now, and they want to eat right, do things right. And, you know, but in order for that to happen, it needs to be a bigger movement where the prices of those products come to a level where, you know, middle America or below could afford those foods. You know, properly raised food just can't be for the wealthy. But I'm optimistic that hopefully we'll continue to move in a good direction with that stuff.
Any advice for young people who are interested in food today who might not have been interested in it years ago?
Absolutely. You know, I would say continue to watch cooking shows. They're fun, but don't think that being a chef is anything like a cooking show. You know, I'm almost 50 years old. I need two knee replacements. My hips are shot and I can't feel my feet most mornings. But I think as long as people, I think that the neat thing is now there's a lot of different culinary paths that are available that never were available when I was a kid. You know, now you could get into food styling, food production, food TV production, things of that nature. You don't just have to go to culinary school to become a chef. But those that do go to culinary school to become a chef realize that there's, you know, it's. I tell people when they say, I want to be a chef, I said, are you ready for the first 20 years of your career? Are you ready to never go to a wedding, never spend a holiday with your family, and work every night till 1 in the morning? And if they say yes, then, you know, we're there. You know, we're moving in the right direction. But I just think that people should know that before they dive into it. You know, when I went to culinary school, there were two culinary schools. Now there's, I don't know how many, but significantly more than two.
What about the changing kitchen culture? Is that something that you've seen over your career?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. I mean, you know, I came from I was trained by German and French chefs that were crazy and abusive, and I mean, I have no complaints. I learned a lot from them, but I think at the kitchen, the culture is a lot friendlier now. It's a lot more diverse now. It was when I graduated from culinary school, we had 67 kids in our graduating class. I think only four of which were women. You know, so there's a lot more balance in the industry now, which is great. The I would say verbal and physical abuse that happened in kitchens is continuing to go in down in the right direction. Hopefully Gordon Ramsay never makes another television show, and that'll help us even more. But yeah, I think it's definitely moving the right way.
We've been talking with celeb chef Michael Simon of The Chew. You can learn more about his restaurants, including Lola, Lolita, Mabel's, and his B-Spot restaurant here in Indianapolis, at michaelsimon.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. We just heard from Cleveland's Iron Chef Michael Simon about what awards can do for a city's dining scene. So it was great to hear this past week that Vita Restaurant in Indianapolis just got a pretty prestigious award, a four-diamond rating from AAA. That makes it one of only a handful of restaurants around the state, and so far, the only one in Indianapolis to get that rating. I stopped in at Vita to talk with Executive Chef Leighton Roberts and General Manager Roddy Kirschenman and find out how things are going at the restaurant, which opened about 8 months ago on East New York Street. Roddy Kirschenman tells us how they found out about the award.
I had received a message from my events manager on a Friday morning, and a message that someone was in the night before and was reviewing us, and so I made the phone call, and she had mentioned that she was from the AAA rating service, and you know, I kind of hesitantly asked how her experience was, and she went to basically explain that everything was fantastic, and that she asked me if I was familiar with the rating system. I said yes, I was, and she then said that she was going to put in a recommendation for us for four diamonds, and I kind of was shocked, just because I know that the list of four diamond restaurants that's on that list is pretty impressive, and you know, we had to keep it quiet until we got the actual letter, which came yesterday. So that's been about 2.5 weeks, I believe.
Now, so Leighton, tell me, what was your response? What did you think when that had happened?
I was kind of taken back. You know, I didn't believe it, I guess, until yesterday. I just thought somebody was playing a joke on us. But yeah, I mean, response was big high fives all around. You know, the staff has been really excited about it, so I think that's a really important thing, and making them feel like they were just as much as us as any of us. You know, I think that was really important. It's a big, you know, uplifting thing for them.
Now, is this something that you were going for particularly? Because, you know, I, as far as I know, no other Indianapolis restaurant has gotten four diamonds. So, is this a conscious effort?
No, I don't think it was not a conscious effort. We didn't never reached out to AAA. They do everything independently, and you know, she was completely anonymous. We had no idea that she was in here.
So, do you even recall who it was or anything?
Nope. I even tried to look in the reservations and couldn't find it. So I'm sure she came under a false name.
Well, that's kind of nice then, that this was a kind of out of the blue. But I imagine that the qualities of the four diamond rating is something that you've been going for all along anyway, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been something that Roddy and I have talked about. This isn't the first restaurant we've been in together. This is number three. So, you know, we've always talked about how awesome it would be to, you know, get a rating like this, or, you know, any of the national ratings. We've always obviously strived for that, and we're really excited about it for sure.
So what do you think? Does this change anything for you?
No. Just makes us want to work harder. I think that just for us, I think for Leighton and I, it's just a stepping stone to, you know, tell us where we are now. But knowing, you know, deep inside both of us, there's a long ways, a lot of growing for us to do, and a lot of refinement, and just to get ourselves to a level that we're happy with.
Now, you've been open, you said, 8 months. What, you know, what more, how do you want to grow beyond that?
you know, we change the menu very often, 4 weeks, 4 to 5 weeks, we change 90% of our menu. And I've seen the evolution of the food and the feel of the more comfortable I get running this restaurant, the more comfortable I think I've been with writing the menus and getting used to the style of not just changing with the seasons, but literally changing, you know, something every 2 weeks, but not just a small thing. You know, we actually change the whole feel of the menu. And I think that's been a growing process of getting my kitchen involved in that as well. So it's not just my food over and over and over again. You know, we're getting influences from them. We've got a guy from Jamaica. We've got a guy from Hawaii. You know, we've got guys from all different backgrounds, and we've, you know, allowing them to feel comfortable and influencing, you know, and actually asking the questions, hey, chef, can we try this? Can we try that? Has influenced my food, and it's changed us for the better for sure.
And you have a well-regarded pastry chef as well?
Yeah, we've got Hattie McDaniel. She's definitely still growing as a pastry chef, but we've seen an evolution of Hattie through the past 8 months, I think, is just in 8 months, I think she's grown tremendously. Her bread game has gotten, you know, from the start where she was scared to make the bread to now she's making, you know, classic poulash French baguettes and, you know, working on sourdoughs and all kinds of different things. She's growing, and she's got a, you know, she's going to be a superstar.
How do you describe the food?
That's a hard one. Roddy might be able to answer that a little better than me, because I mean, you get into the day in and day out of, you know, it feels like you're always doing the same, and you're always like, am I doing okay? Is this food suck? You know, is this food okay? And then, you know, you get something like that, and it really re-energizes you, you know, and knowing that you're doing the right thing and you're going in the right direction. So, I can't say exactly where the food's going to go, Jolene, but, you know, I just say we're going to keep striving to be, you know, as good as we can, you know, just that, I think that's the main goal every day, just get a little better.
So, Roddy, tell me how you describe the restaurant and how the front of the staff is kind of, you know, evolving and growing as you go along.
Well, I think that, you know, we have a lot of, you know, talk about the front of the house staff first, I guess. And, you know, we have a lot of seasoned veterans on our staff, but, you know, a lot of people that have always wanted to work in a kind of classic fine dining style restaurant, but, you know, didn't have a lot of experience in it. And, you know, I think it's taken us, you know, 6 or 8 months to get to a point where they don't have to think about their steps of service anymore. It just automatically happens, you know. And I think, you know, our goal going forward is to just refine that even more and have more finesse on the floor. And, you know, just so that the guest doesn't notice those steps, you know, that's the biggest thing for me, is the guest not noticing somebody that's called in the weeds. You know, we don't want them to feel like they're in the weeds. And I think we've gotten to a point where that's kind of the case now. You know, I think as far as Leighton's food, I mean, I've seen it. I mean, I've worked with Leighton since 2009, and, you know, I've just seen a real evolution and growth in his style of food. I mean, he still cooks food from his soul, but there's a lot more refinement and finesse to it than there was 5 years ago. And it's really cool to see. I mean, we love the tasting menu, because it gives me an opportunity to put wines in front of people that really match with this food. I'm not sure we could have done that 6 years ago.
Tell me a little bit about the tasting menu. Now, that's not particularly common here in Indianapolis to have a regular tasting menu. Tell me a little bit about that.
We try to keep the tasting menu, you know, kind of light, real fresh. We do we always change the tasting menu, usually on the third week. But, you know, we've it's been one of our top sellers. It's what did we sell last Saturday? We sold almost 40. I think tasting menus. So we do a 5-course dinner. You know, it's always paired up. You can get a wine pairing separately. It's at a pretty reasonable price. We stick between $65 and $75, just depending on what ingredients we have.
What about the wine pairings with the tasting menu? Have you got a lot of interest in that?
For us, the wine pairings is an opportunity to put wine in front of people that nobody would ever think about ordering. You know, I remember the second tasting menu we did a Lambrusco with prosciutto and melon, and people like, Lambrusco, what are you doing to me? And that was their favorite wine of the whole pairing, you know. And it's really just trying to find something that's going to be different enough that nobody would ever order that, but yet it's going to match with that food. And it's exciting for us.
Do you have aspirations for recognition for the wine program, the service here at Vita?
Oh, I mean, I think it would always be nice to have those recognitions. But, you know, for me, you know, the guest walking out the door happy is, I mean, that's what it's really all about.
We've been talking with Vita's executive chef, Leighton Roberts, and general manager, Roddy Kirschenman. For more information on the restaurant, go to vita-restaurant.com or look for it on Facebook. City farming. It's not an oxymoron. There's a growing number of urban farms in the Indianapolis area. In fact, last month saw the Indy Grown Harvest Ride, a bicycle tour of more than half a dozen farms around the city. As the interest in urban agriculture continues to grow, Purdue University's Cooperative Extension Service in Marion County continues to be a terrific resource, and a new program is launching next month to help aspiring farmers. The new Urban Agriculture Certificate is a year-long program for urban farmers, market gardeners, school and community garden leaders, and urban homesteaders to help them along the way. Urban agriculture educator Emily Toner helped develop the program, and she fills us in on how the year-long experience can help Indiana's growing community of urban farmers.
Urban agriculture is when people in the city are growing food, growing crops, and raising animals for local consumption. I tend to define it as bigger than just backyard. So if you're growing a vegetable garden in your backyard, I love that. I think it's wonderful. And to fit into the urban agriculture category, I classify it as growing for others. So a school garden could be part of that because it's growing for this community and has other outcomes than just home consumption.
So how much has this grown over the years? There seems to be a big interest in urban ag. Do you see it growing?
Yeah, I do. I think there were a certain amount of urban farms when I started in this position 2.5 years ago, and we've just seen increased interest since then. And, you know, it's not necessarily that the interest itself has sprung up in the last 2.5 years, but as you start to knit together the urban agriculture community, you can see that it's really widespread and start to pull in other people to the community that exists.
So how many different sort of aspects of urban ag do you see?
There are a couple of categories I describe to people. One is the market garden, so somebody that's growing to sell. And that really still could be nonprofit in focus. We have, you know, Growing Places Indy that grows and sells, but they're a nonprofit and have that multifaceted educational wellness approach. But you do have for-profit as well. Community gardens I see is in there. It's a group of people that are using land together to grow. School gardens, and actually I broaden out that school garden category to institutionally driven garden. So Eskenazi's Sky Farm I would put in there, the church that wants to open a garden for their community or to grow for the pantry down the street. All of those I see as urban agriculture projects.
Now, do you think Indianapolis has a big urban ag community? Is it growing?
We have a lot of interest in urban agriculture here. I think you have a real mindset of do it yourself and just get it going here. And, you know, when you compare us to places like Cleveland and Chicago, you can have just as good of an urban farm garden tour here. And we actually just did have a harvest ride last month. It was a bicycle tour that went around to 7 different sites, and you know, that was only a handful of what's actually out there. So we have a lot going on.
Now, tell me about the new Urban Agriculture Certificate and how that program has developed.
The certificate is a really big new program for Purdue Extension. So we're calling it the Urban Agriculture Certificate. It takes you through an entire year-long experience, and we're encouraging people to come in at the beginning of their project, or maybe even you're up to 3 years in, this would still really benefit you. We're going to talk about clarifying your idea, building your team, drawing in resources, and then get into a lot of organic vegetable production training. So you get to do that idea clarification, production training, and then you spend the summer once a month doing field trips with your cohort and visiting experienced urban agriculture project leaders.
So if someone has, you know, an idea for something they want to do, and they're not very far along in sort of the idea process, is this still a fit for them as well?
Definitely, yeah. So you get to think through where that idea is coming from and even try to draw out a vision statement for yourself. And then the organic vegetable production will be handy for you no matter if you're going to start next season or in 3 years. It's stuff to keep in mind. And the further ahead you can plan, the better, actually. So you'll get lots of great ideas and, you know, maybe just get off on the right foot for having come.
Now, it looks like it's very hands-on as well, you know, not all about the planning, but actually, you know, digging in and learning.
Yeah, so the whole goal for students is to leave with a few different plans ready to go and ready to apply to their projects. You'll get a lot of information from experts and from local people who have done these type of projects, but you're going to be applying it to your own project. So you'll leave with basically a mini strategic plan document. You'll have a crop plan and know what seeds you want to get in the ground. You'll have a site assessment where you've done some soil testing, and business and marketing plan for where your crops are going to go.
So tell me when it starts. Now, this is coming right up.
November 2nd. Wednesday, November 2nd is the first class, but registration is open up until the Sunday night before. So October 30th, Sunday, October 30th, that evening is when registration will close. And we have an information session next week on Tuesday, October 25th. So if you are thinking about it and want to learn more, we'll be at South Circle Farm. And from 6 to 7, you can hear from myself and the person who's co-teaching with me, Amy Matthews, who's the owner of South Circle Farm. And Amy wrote the curriculum, and we've been developing it in conjunction with a statewide Purdue Extension team. So by having myself, Purdue Extension urban agriculture educator there, and Amy, the co-owner of South Circle Farm, you'll have the co-instructors there that you can ask questions of.
Well, that seems like a great team. So tell me, what was it like creating this curriculum? It seems like it covers a lot of ground. You know, no pun intended, but it seems like it's very extensive. Was it a good experience to create this?
Yeah, it's a really cool opportunity to turn some of the traditional agricultural resources to benefit a new audience. So the urban audience is smaller scale and has just different parameters around what they're doing. So we had a lot to work with in terms of things that are already out there about organic vegetable production, but shaping that into the curriculum to serve specifically the urban agriculture audience is what took the most effort. And Amy Matthews, as our curriculum writer, had an incredible amount of experience. She's guided projects in Cleveland and in Chicago, and those had different focuses with youth education and different job training focus. And then here she does her own market farm and is incredibly successful with that. So her experience really helped drive what's included in the curriculum.
Now tell me the cost of it and any other details that people need to know if they're maybe interested in checking it out.
Mm-hmm. So you can sign up online, and the cost is $400 for the entire year experience, which includes the field trips, your workbook and supplies that you'll get, and gosh, I haven't even counted, but we'll just say dozens of classes. And the online link you fill out, and you can pay with a credit card there. If you want to pay with check for some reason, I can provide you with a paper form, which we have had one person say, as a product for my nonprofit business, I want to use a check. So we can do either of those. And what you'll get after you sign up is a Purdue login account, which will lead you to our online learning platform, which will be a key piece of your experience.
But the information session that's coming up, there's no charge for that?
No charge. Come on out, and you'll get to see a beautiful urban farm, South Circle Farm, and then we'll be there for an hour talking. And as with any event with urban agriculture, the true value are the people that you meet there, and it's always just wonderful people. So you can come out and at least chat with some new folks.
We've been talking with Purdue Extension Marion County's urban agriculture educator, Emily Toner. For more information on the new agriculture certificate, go to purdue.edu/DFFS/urban ag. beer scene in Indianapolis continues to grow, and we will have another new brewery soon when Cannonball Brewing Company opens at 17th and Bellefontaine Streets in Indianapolis. I stopped by the brewery recently to talk with brewer Mark Swartz and his wife Tanya to hear about how the whole project got started.
I was an airline pilot for ATA, and we traveled the world drinking different beers. And so I got to experience a lot of different kinds of beer that way. And I just, it started brewing beer at home, and it kind of grew from that. And,
well, when was that?
Probably 12 years ago I started.
So you've been at this a while.
I have.
So How did that go? I mean, were you just making small batches? Did you start with the kits like so many people start with? Or how did it develop?
With me, I did it about two kits and then went on and started doing my own.
How do you go, though, from brewing beer at home to thinking, I'm going to have a brewery? You know, it's a dream for a lot of people. I think you're probably living the dream for a lot of home brewers.
Right. That's why I'm starting. It's a two-barrel system. It's a very small commercial system. So I wanted to start small because I have not done this before. So
how does this, the smaller systems work? You know, we're used to seeing the huge barrels of our bigger production breweries.
This one, it works off of basically the same system I have at home for my homebrew system, only on a larger scale. So I brew 10 gallons at home, but this will brew 62.
Okay, so you can do that amount at a time?
Yes.
So what kind of beers have you brewed, and was there a learning curve? Is there, you know, some that you got into brewing and that we can expect to see here?
I think with brewing, it's kind of like cooking, where it's a natural progression where you just kind of experiment and get better and then learn different nuances of it where it gets better each mm-hmm. time.
Any favorites?
I love Saisons and the Belgians, and I love those types of beer. I enjoy them all. I really do. I'm kind of more seasonal with it. I definitely don't drink many stouts in the summertime, but and they're more, for me, they're more of a winter, fall type of beer.
But then how do you get to the point of, you know, you're brewing at home and you have a nice hobby going and probably people like it, but then how do you make that leap to thinking, I'm going to open something?
It's a tough question. It really is. I think it has a lot to do with ATA going out of business.
Right.
And realizing kind of the airline industry is not where I wanted to be anymore, and started looking around and looking at what I enjoyed doing, and I could see myself going to work and brewing beer every day.
Now, had you ever had any kind of background in this sort of business?
No, not at all. None.
Well, tell me what you think. You know, how do you see the progression of Cannonball?
Okay, so, well, like he was saying with, you know, aviation, after ATA went out of business, you know, he was really struggling to try to find a place for himself and, you know, where he fit and what he wanted to do. And it was very hard for him to get back into flying because, you know, back in 08 was when they went under. And so many other airlines did. And so it was just really, really tough to try to get back into. So, you know, we actually sat and watched a documentary one day I can't think of his name, from Dogfish Head did. And anyway, you know, Mark just looked at me and said, you know, you just never see a ticked off brewer, you know? And so I think that was kind of this moment. He had this epiphany where he was like, you know, maybe this is what I'm going to do. And so I think it just kind of, that started the ball rolling, really, or the thought process of it anyway.
Did it take long to come around to the idea of, hey, we're going to open a brewery?
I've been looking at buildings for years. I think that was the hardest part. About 2-3 years I've been looking for buildings.
Oh, yeah. At least,
Yeah, so I think that's been the hardest part, is finding the right space.
So what appealed about this space? So you're at 17th and Bellefontaine in Indianapolis, not a very high traffic neighborhood. So people might not be familiar with the neighborhood. What appealed about this location?
I think that because we lived in Heron Morton, which is so close, and we were able to watch the growth there and how it changed so much, I think it was just kind of exciting to be a part of that again, but on the business side. I think this is going to spur, a lot more growth here. I think that just having us here will make other people want to maybe, have a business nearby, and having the Monon two blocks away, I think is going to be a lot of bike traffic and foot traffic. Sure. So I think that'll help.
What'd you think when you saw the building? Could you imagine it as a brewery when you first walked in?
I could. It was in horrible shape, but for some reason it spoke to me. I decided then that's where I wanted to do this.
Really? Okay, now what did it say? How did it speak to you? What did you see in it?
I just saw the perfect size space and the old building, and at that time the garage door was not in, so I just saw the potential of this was the perfect size of what I wanted.
So now tell me how it's going to all work. You have some tanks behind the bar, you have more in the basement. How does that system work?
We'll be brewing upstairs behind the bar, and then the fermenters will be downstairs, and we'll just be serving the through the draft system right from the walk-in. Hopefully it'll be mainly pints and growlers to go is what we'll start with.
So what kind of beers can we expect?
It'll be all over the place.
Well, now that's fun. How so? Tell me a little bit more.
Since I've been brewing at home for 12 years, I have probably a couple hundred recipes at home. So I'm just looking forward to picking out the best ones and just come in and brew what you feel like doing and talk to Erin and see what she wants to make and kind of do some nice pairings.
We've been talking with Mark and Tanya Swartz of Cannonball Brewing Company. The grand opening is set for November 12th and 13th. Stay with us for more about Cannonball's food when we talk with Chef Erin Kemm here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We love our local craft beer here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. But I'm all about the food. And I'm pretty excited that when Cannonball Brewing Company opens at 17th and Bellefontaine in Indianapolis next month, there will be a familiar chef in the kitchen. Erin Kemm, who many of us know from the highly acclaimed R Bistro, will be creating a unique menu for the brewery. I talked with Erin and Cannonball owners Mark and Tanya Swartz about what sort of food we can expect when Cannonball opens in November.
Well, I'm excited to work with Mark and Tanya. I've known them for a number of years now. Tanya actually worked with me at our bistro, and his ever-changing beer palette and offerings, I hope to kind of do the same with the food. I don't want the food to be an afterthought. Most tasting rooms just right. Have food because they have to,
right.
But I want people to come for the beer and stay for the food.
Oh, I like that. So tell me what we can expect. Now, I have seen the downstairs area. It's small, but then you're used to working in kind of a small space. So what do you envision the menu might be like?
I think we'll have a few staple items that'll probably change seasonally because that's sort of my cup of tea from our bistro. I get bored if the menu lasts more than a week. So yeah. So I expect things. We'll have some staples, and then I love ethnic food, so I think we'll incorporate a lot of different ethnicities. I'm already thinking about empanadas and curries and things like that really go well with beer. And mindful matching of beer and food.
Now, is that a challenge? We hear, we've heard a lot in the past years about beer dinners and, beer pairings, but they sometimes don't seem as natural as
wine pairings, for example. So is that a challenge, you know, working with the beers and the different flavor profiles?
It's a fun challenge. I think it's almost easier. I think beer is almost more food-friendly than wines, and so often I taste a beer and I immediately get a flavor in mind.
That's very cool. So how does that work? When you taste something, what are you thinking?
You know, I think of the heartiness of the beer versus the food. So we have like matching, you know, I don't want the beer to overpower the food, but, you know, we're talking about a Thai basil beer, and that just seems like an easy thing to, an easy starting point for a delicious Asian dish or something to incorporate some of the flavors from the beer.
So a Thai basil beer,
right.
You have to tell me a little bit about that. That's not a flavor profile that I see very often when, you know, when we're talking about beer.
It's a lighter, more of a summertime. It's kind of, I think of it as my lawnmower beer. It's a Thai basil ginger beer that I've been brewing for quite a few years now. And it's definitely just a golden ale with the flavor, with the Thai basil and ginger.
So now I need to ask, what other sort of interesting combinations have you been working with over the years?
Oh, gosh. You know, I would have to... You have to come in and see. Because it's all over the place.
You know, are there some things you're, you know, looking forward to, Aaron, you know, looking forward to working with?
Oh, definitely. I think still, you know, working seasonally is just a natural thing to do for the beers and for just, you know, the way I like to design a menu. I'm really excited about, you know, doing some amazing stuff from scratch. You know, we're talking about making our own tortillas and things like that with different interesting combinations that aren't necessarily, you know, classically Mexican. We're looking at like a rye tortilla with corned beef, almost like a Reuben.
That sounds good.
Have a beer with it.
It does,
you know?
Scream, have a beer.
So just fun vehicles for different items that, you know, will match really great with the beers.
Now, tell me a little bit about what people can expect in the tasting room itself. You know, you mentioned the garage door that you have that opens up to the sidewalk. Any other, you know, descriptions that you could give for people? Kind of give them an idea of what it's going to be like?
Wow. Well, yeah, I mean, so the feel we're looking for is just kind of cozy but industrial, and a lot of reclaimed aspects we're going to use in here. So we'll have a drink rail at the garage door, so there'll at least be probably about 5 bar stools, which will be really nice when it's nice out. We could have the door open. We'll have some tables in the back. Mostly we'll have bar seating, and then we're looking at putting some seating out on the patio as well that will be fenced in eventually.
And you have this beautiful communal table up front, so that's very pretty too.
Well, thanks. Yes, this was a great find from Society of Salvage that came out of Central State. So so we had fun reworking it and making it look pretty. So
Mark, if you could tell me just a little bit about the system and the capacity, just so that I know from, you know, how much you'll be making and how much you can make and that sort of stuff.
Okay, well, it's a electric, all-electric two-barrel system. We're starting off with 8 beers we'll have on tap. So, and we have 7 fermenters and 7 bright tanks, so we'll be serving right from the bright tanks. So
do you have an idea of what those first beers might be?
I'm working on that right now. Lately, I've been so busy with the build-out, I actually have not been able to brew for about 4 months now. I know, it's killing me. I'd rather be brewing beer than laying tile, but...
I guess you got to get that tile in.
I have to get there, yes, so...
Okay, now you have to talk a little bit about beer brunch. That sounds like a great idea.
People seem to love beer brunches. I mean, brunch people love anyway, but when they're paired, the food is paired with beer, even more so. So it's a great way for people to get to try everything you offer, because you offer small pours, small courses. I think it's a great kind of great way to promote your beers. and I think we'd have a full house.
I think you would too. So now I have to think of special dinners and things like that. It just seems like the it's a blank slate, you know, that you could do all sorts of things.
Right. I think, you know, thematic dinners, seasonal dinners they just sort of write themselves. The menus write themselves. So, I think people are really into that, too.
I think so. Now, Mark, would you brew beer to fit a particular menu, or would you, Aaron, create the menu to fit a particular beer?
I think we'll do both, actually. I looking forward to working together and collaborating on that, where we could do it either way. I mean, I'm sure we'll do it both ways.
Yeah.
So.
I think being a small operation, we can change whatever we want on our whim. And I think that's a great way to operate for something like beer, because it is like a relaxed environment. And I think people are, easily pleased with some good beer. And then, hopefully they'll be surprised at how good the food is.
We've been talking with Chef Aaron Kam of Cannonball Brewing Company in Indianapolis. The brewery's grand opening will be November 12th and 13th. For more information, look for Cannonball on Facebook. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and D Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our program today. And thanks also to our guests, Cleveland's Iron Chef, Michael Simon, Vita's Executive Chef, Leighton Roberts, and General Manager, Roddy Kirschenman, Emily Toner, Urban Agriculture Educator with Purdue Extension, Marion County, and Mark and Tanya Swartz and Chef Aaron Kam of Cannonball Brewing Company in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, and D Radio.